for this guy for hosting us in his wonderful conference room. Thank you, Jack. And we ask you to please shut off cell phones and pagers. And if you wouldn't mind holding questions until the end of the program when John Harris will conduct a Q&A session. Now about our speaker. Today, the Middle East Forum is pleased to present Jonathan Shanzer. Mr. Shanzer, an expert on terrorist groups, has written extensively on Palestinian politics, Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in the Arab world, areas of weak central authority in the Middle East, and the Arab Street. Currently, Mr. Shanzer is a star fellow at the Washington Institute specializing in Arab and Islamic politics. Formerly, he was a research fellow here at the Middle East Forum, where I've had the pleasure to work with him over the years. He received his MA in Middle East Studies at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where he focused on fundamentalist Islamic movements. He's worked for CNN, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Truman Institute at Hebrew University, and the Consulate General of Israel in Atlanta. In addition, Mr. Shanzer has traveled extensively in the Middle East and is fluent in Hebrew and Arabic. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Jonathan Shanzer.
Well, thank you for that warm introduction, and thanks for coming out today. It's great to be back at the forum, just sort of where I feel like I cut my teeth here, so it's always nice to come back. What I want to do today is talk a little bit about Arab media, how the war was covered in the Arab press, and to talk also about a phenomenon that a lot of experts sort of miscalculate, and that is the Arab Street. There's a lot that's said about the Arab Street, what the Arab world is thinking. There's sort of a sense that there's some sort of mass, unanimous, disaffected youth on the Arab Street that's angered over American foreign policy, and there's a sense that we should all sort of be very fearful of it. So I want to take a look at what happened on that so-called Arab Street as well today. But first, just to talk a little bit about Al Jazeera, and to quote a friend of mine in Washington who runs the Radio Sawa station, it has been during this war a weapon of mass deception. This is a channel that has done irreparable damage, in my opinion, to our opinion of America on the street. And I would actually say that there is no such thing as one Arab street that's sort of, you know, it's monolithic, but you can tell where the damage has been done. We'll get into that in a minute. In the past, I should mention that most of the Arab world used to get its information from state-run television and radio or state-run newspapers or even some other newspapers from outside the Arab world. And what you would always see is these sort of deceptive headlines and stories about how there was an imminent victory, whether it be over the Israelis in 48 or 67. There was always a sense that the Arab world was on the cusp of victory. And then all of a sudden, as the war ended, and inevitably it ended in loss, there would sort of be this silence. We're not really ready to own up to it. You know, if you look at the 67 war, for instance, you know, we're going to drive the enemy into the sea. We're going to win. Victory is imminent. And then, you know, the final headline on, whatever it was, June 11th, was ceasefire. And that's the kind of thing where it's just sort of silence. And this is actually what happened on Al Jazeera as well as Al-Manar, which is Hezbollah's television station, Abu Dhabi, which is a sort of a vitriolic offspin of Jazeera as well. The difference is that this time around, Al Jazeera's only been around since 1996, I believe, or maybe 1997. This is the first time we've actually seen a full war that has been covered in real time, maybe short of the ongoing Arab-Israeli violence right now. This is really the first time we've been able to see war 24/7 in this way. The first Gulf War, we didn't see the same kind of coverage. In fact, Al Jazeera wasn't around. People tuned into CNN or BBC, they didn't get the same kind of disinformation. So this time the lies were in real time, and the Arab world was just sort of feeding off of it constantly. And just to give you an idea of some of the stuff, I had the unfortunate honor of having to monitor the Arab press for the Washington Institute. And I have to tell you, it was I was just sort of constantly walking around in a bad mood. A couple times, it affected me so much, I was going to go out and demonstrate on the streets. I mean, it was a sort of, it really has an effect on you. And so the sorts of things that I saw were, for instance, Donald Rumsfeld would come on. And, you know, Al Jazeera would say, well, you know, we present the opinion and the other opinion. That's their motto. And so Rumsfeld would come on TV, and he would talk about, he would say, the coalition forces. Now, the translation was occupation forces. of a general sense of the kind of thing that you'd hear. Sometimes they would correct themselves, sometimes they wouldn't. It didn't really matter. The whole idea was is that, you know, this is what they're hearing first. Another thing, Powell would come on every once in a while. Secretary of State Powell would come on, and then what would happen is he would make a lot of great points. He would talk about Reconstruction after the war and the sort of moral and ethical ideas that the United States had for Reconstruction inside Iraq. And then what would happen is after that, they would have another guy on, Kamal Quds Al-Arabi, a Saudi-funded newspaper. He would come on and essentially dispel everything that Powell said, essentially leaving any effect that Powell had completely negligible. You were sort of back at square one, and they would immediately go back to images of destruction, exploding munitions, crying babies with bandages on their heads, B-52 bombers, ominous music. In fact, this was what I'm explaining is actually a montage that Al Jazeera played about every 10 or 15 minutes. And it just says the war on Iraq, or the war against Iraq. Not the war with Iraq, not the American-Iraq war, but the war against Iraq. And then this ominous music and the same montage over and over and over again. And I can tell you, watching it, it was an extremely powerful experience for me, not having really spent that much time watching Arab media. You could just get a sense of where the hatred was coming from. Probably the worst thing that I saw was, if you remember, two Saturdays ago, if you turn on Fox News, Greg Kelly, this is the reporter that was embedded with the Marines, he was reporting constantly on the progress. And you actually saw, when you turn on the news that Saturday morning, you could see a column of tanks, armored vehicles rolling through Baghdad. It was the first time we'd seen pictures of that. And essentially, you know, the gunner in the front tank was just mowing down everything that got in his way. And it was very, very clear that the tide had turned. There was no doubt about it that the United States was rolling on Baghdad and the war was close to ending. I turned it on to Al Jazeera, just curious as to what was going on, and what I saw were five pot-bellied, middle-aged Arab men with Kalashnikovs jumping up and down on the one tank that was disabled. And down at the bottom, in Arabic, it said, the Iraqi forces have dispelled the invaders from Saddam Airport. And this is the kind of thing that we saw over and over and over again. And it was extremely frustrating to watch because you knew that people were buying this. This is the station, this is the CNN of the Arab world, and this is what people were believing. And it was just such misinformation. My fear is that there will be somewhat of a backlash. If you read any of the sort of historical accounts on the emergence of Islamic fundamentalism or radical Islam, as Daniel calls it, what you see is that there's always a disconnect when the Arab world or the Muslim world at large has expected victory. And then you have that disconnect where they don't achieve that kind of victory. They don't achieve that kind of hegemony. In general, Islamic fundamentalism comes from the idea of that Islam is slated to be the top religion, that God has ordained, that Allah has ordained Islam or the Arab world to be number one. And when it did not reach that, that's when you saw the kinds of violence and fundamentalist interpretations come out. And what my fear is that long term, Al Jazeera and other channels like Al Manar, Abu Dhabi, may have had that kind of effect. You had an Islamic and an Arab world that was expecting victory. I mean, really expecting victory for about 3 weeks. And then all of a sudden, you turn on the TV, I remember watching Abu Dhabi the day that the statue fell, and it was dead silence. You just watched the statue fall, and there was just no commentary. They didn't know what to say. I mean, here they were, whipping up fury all the way through the Arab world, and then all of a sudden, nothing. And then finally, one of the announcers came on and said, "This is a sad day for the Arab world." Why do you say that? I mean, I would think that, you know, you're watching all these Iraqis cheering and stomping up and down on Saddam's face, etc. He said, well, it's a shame because the Arab world didn't do it themselves. And that's why this was a shame. But anyway, what my fear is that you'll see some sort of a bottom drop out among people who are expecting this kind of victory. And this could be problematic. The hope, of course, is that these stations have been discredited. I can't tell you if they have or they haven't yet, but you know, you have an Arab world that was expecting something very different than what they saw on television. In fact, there have been in a lot of the newspapers right now throughout the Arab world, you have people actually talking about how were we misled, why were we misled, what's been going on, how can we fix this. There's a lot of introspection going on. There's a new Middle East television network that the United States is putting out through the State Department. It was actually just voted in through Congress. There's about $62 million that's going to be put towards this right now. The hope is that these stations will begin to try to compete with this American station and probably try to get some real scoops. Now, I can't tell you whether that's going to happen or not, but this is the hope right now as this network is set to launch. But what I think what some of these, what the Arab media also did is it dispelled some myths. And I want to talk about those. First, I think, is the myth of the jihadi fighter. There is a sense throughout the Muslim world that if you have these foreign irregulars, regular Muslims that come from other lands and join this sort of jihad fight, that they're destined to victory. In fact, this is where Al-Qaeda came from, if everyone remembers, from the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan throughout the 1980s, which ended in 1989. The Soviets were repelled. And this had, at least to, with some help from irregular fighters, from people that came from Egypt, from Sudan, from Yemen, from all over the place, and with the funding of people like Osama bin Laden and Abdullah Azzam and other figures that we've now heard about over and over again, there's been a mythology that's been built up. That is, you know, once you get jihadi fighters in, well, this is the turning point in the war. This is where the tide's going to turn. What we've seen actually over recent years, since Afghanistan, if you look at Bosnia, if you look at Chechnya, they've been weak models. The jihad model has not worked again. And they tried it again this time. You know, we had people streaming in over the Syrian border. You had people from Sudan, from Yemen, from Egypt, from Lebanon, from Syria. You know, irregular fighters, up to 6,000, maybe even more than that. I was talking to a Pentagon official about this the other day, and he said, you know what, let them send as many as they need to. He called them cannon fodder. These people are not able to stand up to the American military. And in fact, one Marine actually said, let them all come, we can fight them all on one front. Let's just fight the war on terror all in one place. But what this has done, and it's a little funny, but it's also a little sad, and this was their big, you know, resistance. This was their stand. And what's happened is there's been actually very little effect. And so the hope is that maybe that myth will be dispelled, that this whole idea of a regular fighter streaming in for the cause of Allah, maybe that will be dispelled a little bit, because honestly, they've been extremely ineffectual thus far. The other thing, and this will be the bulk of what we talk about for the rest of the time here, and that's in the Arab Street. If you listen to what various pundits had to say about the Arab Street before the war began, if you listen to what politicians had to say, I'll give you a couple of quotes. Hosni Mubarak last summer, president of Egypt, said that disorder and chaos may prevail in the region should war erupt. You had Arab countries that came to the UN in February and said that, quote, the extent of destabilization in the region and uncertainty in Iraq in the case of war go far beyond our imagination. Or Amr Moussa, secretary general of the Arab League, said that war could, quote, open the gates of hell, end quote. And these are the sorts of things that we heard about, and you know, to a certain extent, I think policymakers were getting a little nervous. People were wondering, you know, is this going to happen? Can we afford to launch this war? You know, we see the benefits, but what are the negatives? And people kept saying, well, here are these intangibles. Be ready. This is the kind of thing that's going to, you know, you're opening up, you know, a can of worms that you won't be able to close. It's going to be Pandora's box. And when you turned on the television on March 20th, right after we launched the war, it really looked like that's what was going on. The Arab world was going crazy. There were hundreds of thousands of people that spilled out in the streets of Cairo. People were clashing with riot police. They were throwing police barricades all over the place. In Damascus and in Bahrain and Beirut, there were people that tried to actually rush the British and U.S. embassies. And in some cases, people were injured quite badly. And in the worst case that I saw, actually, the first day after, I think it was actually the Friday after the war was launched on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, that Friday after Friday prayers, people were throwing furniture off of Al-Aqsa Mosque on the people below. I mean, it was pandemonium. And the idea was that, oh my God, this is it. You know, this is the time that the Arab Street has erupted. But what I want to do is, I actually want to look at what happened before and after this sort of eruption of the Arab Street, because what actually you see is sort of a bell curve. You saw things sort of fizzle. It was very, very small demonstrations in the beginning. They ramped up a little bit. They reached a peak, and then what you watched was it just sort of petered out. And that's exactly what happened here. And what it actually showed was that the Arab Street, it was an eruption unlike we'd ever seen before, but it's still not that sort of thing that we should all, you know, fear. You know, there's no reason to actually fear this. I'm going to try to show that maybe there's some good things that came out of it. So what happened before the war is that maybe a couple hundred people, maybe even up to 1,000 in Cairo, came out into the streets. They were unauthorized. And by the way, when I say unauthorized, you have demonstrations in the Arab world are always have to go through the proper channels. You have to go to the Ministry of Interior. You have to get some sort of authorization. You have to pick the right place. You have to set the date. It's a long process if you want to actually demonstrate, because you know, repression in the Arab world is very commonplace. People aren't really allowed to go out and speak their mind on the Arab street. So what you saw is a couple of small, spontaneous little eruptions, but there was really nothing. It was overshadowed by what I would call the Western Street. But if you looked at the streets of London, of Paris, of Washington, there were hundreds of thousands of people that were coming out and demonstrating against this imminent war. We didn't see, I mean, it just paled in comparison on the Arab street. In fact, there was one columnist in the Al-Haram Daily that said, where did all the Arab anger go? They actually wrote a column about it, trying to sort of prompt people to get out of the street because they just didn't know what happened. There's this mythology on the Arab street that the street's so strong, and you had a state-run newspaper saying, hey, where'd you guys go? And so it was very interesting to see how quiet it was right off the bat. What you saw leading up in February and March, what you saw was a couple hundred thousand people who would come out in the streets in Cairo, in Sudan, in Yemen. But what's interesting is that they were co-opted by the regime. These were actually sponsored by the regime. The regime said, okay, we're having a big demonstration today. Everybody come out. It was actually very interesting that the largest one was about 500,000 people in Cairo. And it was sponsored by Hosni Mubarak. And it was basically a rally for his party. It was just to try to drum up a little support. He said a few things that were anti-war, and then everybody went home. And that was the big one. Another big one was in Yemen, about 200,000 people. And that was a pre-election rally. The president of Yemen decided to just bring people out so he could say a few things against the war and said, okay, everybody, the elections are slated, I think, for next week, for next Sunday. So the way of him to try to drum up a little support for him and his party and for his supporters. And that's the way this went, right up until March 20th. Then for about 5 or 6 days, you saw some serious violence erupt. And you saw it in, I have a list here, Egypt, Yemen, Jordan, Libya, Lebanon, Syria, Palestinian territories, Bahrain, Sudan. They're quite sizable. There was a good bit of violence. People were clashing with security, etc. That said, two people were shot in Yemen. A couple people were killed in Sudan. In Bahrain, there was a good bit of clashing. There was an explosion near an American enclave. But I should say, at the same time, it was actually quite quiet in the United Arab Emirates, in Kuwait, in Oman, Algeria, Morocco. Everything was quite quiet. And then what you saw after that was the regime began to take control again. But they let these things, they were spontaneous eruptions, and they let them happen. And then what the regime began to do was clamp down again. And what you saw is that falling action. Just in the same way that it ramped up, it began to ramp down. The regimes began to co-opt things again. They began to usher people into stadiums. They controlled the violence. They controlled the anger. And then right now what you see on the Arab street is almost dead quiet. It's basically done. You know, this is the last breath of life coming out of the Arab street right now. Now, how does this fit within history? Historically, the Arab street has been a non-factor, an absolute non-factor. In fact, people were worrying about it before the 1991 Gulf War. People were worried about it time and time again. If you do this, the Arab street is going to erupt. You have to be very careful about the Arab street. You have these people that could overturn regimes, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you actually look at history, in 1952 in Egypt, in 1958 in Iraq, and in 1969 in Sudan were the only times that there was any amount of street activity in overturning a regime. The most amount of activity we've seen has either been with bread riots, with people who have been upset about economic conditions in Tunisia and Jordan, Morocco, etc. And probably the largest demonstration we've seen in recent years was a demonstration in Morocco. There were about 1 million people that came out to demonstrate against granting women's rights. That was probably the largest one we've seen, actually, in the Arab world in recent decades. The exception to that, of course, is the Palestinian Intifada, which began in September 2000. There were spontaneous eruptions after that, but not so large. You know, maybe 10 or 20,000 people, not the scope that we saw in New York or in Washington. So there's quite a bit of repression, as I mentioned. Daniel actually has written a couple of pieces about this, and he noted that after the killings in Sabra and Shatila in 1982, or the Salman Rushdie affair in 1989, no reaction. And the Gulf War, people stay at home and watch television. So historically, this sort of fits into place that, you know, that the Arab street hasn't had that much to say about what's been going on. But to the extent that there was some activity out on the Arab street, I actually think it was a good thing. I think that it was, despite the fact that it was vehemently anti-American, vehemently anti-Israel, vehemently anti-Israel, I thought it was a very, very good thing. Why? Because the whole idea is that these regimes, they have not allowed for a lot of repression in recent years. And one of the goals that America set out, you know, before this war in Iraq, and just in general after 9/11, was we were going to try to infuse a little bit of liberalization into the Arab world right now. What this actually did, whether we knew it or not, but by launching this war, by going after Iraq, by disarming it, by getting rid of its weapons of mass destruction, etc., and by promoting regime change, we're also seeing these regimes didn't quite know how to keep a lid on their public. And what happened is the public erupted spontaneously, and these people, the regimes, allowed this to happen. So what's happened in the past is that a lot of people think, analysts believe, that terrorism has come about because there has been this much oppression. If you're not able to express your dissent, if there is no chance to actually speak your mind, then there's an incredible amount of sort of pent-up hostility and anger and sort of a natural outgrowth of that. So what you're seeing right now is a corollary that inside the Arab world right now, they are allowed to sort of speak out. They're allowed to vent their anger. They're allowed to breathe a little bit. This could be a germ, just the beginning of perhaps a new wave of democratization in the world, in the Arab world. They may allow for a little bit more of this in times to come, and especially as we see more liberalization inside Iraq. The hope is you'll be seeing more and more of this in the months to come. And just to give you an example, by the way, in Tunisia, this was the first time in more than 10 years that the opposition was actually even allowed to march in the Arab world. And in Iraq, by the way, we're seeing a lot of protests right now, Sunnis and Shiites coming together, etc. This is, as I see it, probably the beginning of some sort of civil society. This is really the first time that we've seen that in Iraq in decades. So it'll actually be very exciting to see how people express themselves, to make sure that they do it in a nonviolent way. As long as it stays at this level, which is just saying we want American troops out, we want to decide for ourselves, this is the kind of thing that can make Iraqis actually feel as if they are winning back their independence, whether they do it through nonviolent protests or through other means. Just by even being able to express themselves in this way, I think is a very, very good sign and something we really haven't seen so much in the Arab world. Now, there is one street I should mention that continues to have a voice. And this is probably the one area of concern that I still have out of all these streets, and that's been the Palestinians. The Palestinians have had probably the most virulent voice on the Arab street since this started. They haven't had the same numbers as all of the other communities. But you have tens of thousands of people coming out, but what they've been doing is, in most of these places, it hasn't been pro-Saddam. It's been anti-American or anti-war. In the Palestinian territories, they still cling to the hope that Saddam is still around. In fact, there are conspiracy theories that Saddam cut a deal, but he's going to come back, or that Saddam still could liberate the Palestinian people. They saw him as some sort of a savior, and they're still clinging to it in a desperate kind of way. But what you saw was on the streets, they were chanting that Saddam should attack Tel Aviv, that Saddam should attack with chemical weapons. This was sort of the nastiest rhetoric that we saw. It was only coming out of Palestinian territories. And, I think that, people are saying right now that this is perhaps a window for the Arab-Israeli peace process to come back on track. I don't believe it. I think that what we saw right now in the streets is a fairly good indication that the Palestinians are not ready, and we're going to have to wait and let Abu Mazen and the new cabinet try to get control of the people, try to sort of change course a little bit. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I think that you need to see that sort of behavioral change first on the ground, among the Arab streets, because what we saw right now is that the Palestinians are really no closer to accepting Israel than they were before this war started, before the Intifada erupted in September of 2000, or even before that. So in that sense, that's probably the one negative area that I would look at right now. But in short, though, I think that this war has actually been very, very positive. I think it shed a lot of light on a couple of things that we had a couple of misconceptions about, including the idea of foreign irregulars. We really cast some light on how terrible the media has been inside the Arab world, and hopefully we'll begin to see a little bit more dissent being allowed on the street, not under the street or the Arab basement, as some people call it, but right up on the street, of people being allowed to express their dissent, political dissatisfaction, etc. Hopefully begin to see a little bit of a change in the Arab world. So with that, I guess we'll close, and I guess...
Yeah?
Okay.
Questions.
Okay. That's true. That's what always goes first.
When you speak about the Arab world, you're not speaking about the Muslims also, are you? Are you just speaking about the Arabs?
I'm speaking specifically about the Arab street, the Arab world. I was not watching the rest of the Muslim world.
Now, what percentage does the Arab world make up of compared to the Muslim world?
I think... The bulk of the Muslim world is actually in Southeast Asia and other places.
Which is what about?
I'm not sure what the numbers are. I think probably 50 or 65% is out of the Arab world.
The billion point three,
I think.
250 million.
Yeah.
There's over a billion Muslims in the world.
That's right.
How many Arabs are in the world?
250 million.
Around that.
So it's about 25%.
Correct. Are Arabs, okay. Now, how does this relate to the Muslims? They are the fundamentalist Muslim race.
Well, you know, I can tell
you. Are very, very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare with what the Arabs are trying to do?
Well, you saw a similar trend among the rest of the Muslim world, although I would say not to the same extreme. I think that the attack on Iraq resonated more inside the Arab world at large. You saw a lot of protests. Well, you actually saw a good bit of protest in Iran as well. But I didn't see a whole lot of focus on the Philippines or Indonesia or other countries with large populous Muslim populations, or even Nigeria for that matter. There wasn't a whole lot of it, or at least it wasn't covered to the extent that the Arab world was. There were demonstrations. I don't think they were as violent. I don't think they were as widespread or continuous as they were for the opening days of the war, as they were in the Arab world. That's not to say that they don't pose the same sort of threat that the radical Islamic movement inside these other areas don't pose that kind of threat. But I can tell you that a lot of the movements inside the Arab world weren't necessarily radical Islamic or Islamic fundamentalists. This was a sort of a natural outgrowth of anger that one of the countries of the Arab world was being invaded, as they saw it, by a foreign power. And this was a natural backlash on their part. They were very uncomfortable with it. But more importantly, I should actually mention that the people who were the most uncomfortable were probably the regimes themselves. They have a number of regimes inside the Arab world that are illegitimate. They took power by illegitimate means. And here we have the United States coming in and actually dismantling an illegitimate regime. And what you saw was there's a lot of nervousness. People in the regime in Egypt, particularly we're seeing right now, the regime in Syria is very, very nervous. I mean, there are a lot of parallels. In fact, if you look at Syria is probably far worse in the development of chemical and biological weapons, and in the support of terrorist groups for that matter. So I think that they were very, very nervous about this, and you continue to see it today, actually, with the back and forth between American and Syrian diplomats.
I have a question that will go. You mentioned that Al Jazeera had caused amazing damage throughout the Arab world as we got closer and closer to the war and as the war progressed.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, they've obviously backed the wrong horse. So do we see this as a possibility of a lack of credibility in the Arab world, and that somehow they'll have to account for this mistake to their own Arab bodies?
Well, there's been a little bit of that introspection, that soul searching right now in the Arab press. Particularly for the week after Baghdad fell, if you looked at Al-Quds Al-Arabi, Al-Quds, Al-Sharq Al-Azad, a lot of the major papers inside the Arab world, there were, just looking at the headlines, it was saying, how were we misled? What happened? Why did we think one thing and another thing happened? So there is a sense of that. But I think that in general, a lot of people, and including the director of policy planning at the Washington Institute right now, has been very much opposed to this new American channel. Even though I think it's probably a very important development to actually have an American channel out there that actually puts out, real information, the kind of news that we see here, free information. The fear is that a channel like the Middle East Television Network is going to be seen as sort of a CIA-funded, it's going to be all sorts of conspiracy theory. The Arab world will be reluctant to see this because they're going to think that it's disinformation being pumped in from America, rather than going to CNN or their CNN like Al Jazeera or other channels, which they know is Arab-run, Arab-operated, Arab correspondents on the ground, speaking fluent Arabic, etc. They're going to trust that a little bit more because it's their own people. Now the question is will we be able to overcome that? And my hope is that we will. I think it's going to take a little bit of time to ramp up before we can actually get credibility on the ground, but I think it'll take a little while.
To dovetail on that for a second, the Al Jazeera thing, do you think that Al Jazeera will change as a result of all of this?
I think, one of the things that I think that most of us forget is that Al Jazeera probably did what they did because it was marketing. I mean, they wanted to give people what they wanted to hear. So for probably 3 weeks straight, and you actually heard reports out of the Arab world, the people would stay up until 4 or 5 in the morning and only get two or three hours sleep before going to work the next day because they were so glued to their television set. This gave Al Jazeera an incredible sort of boost in popularity. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why it was simple marketing. It was just just trying to, you know, give people what they wanted to hear. My hope now is that they're going to start to change. I mean, there is a lot of criticism. There is a lot of, you know, a lot of people saying, you know, how did this happen? Why have we been misled? But the interesting thing is that it is still seen as the most moderate and probably the most credible source of news. If you look at Al-Manar, Al-Manar is the Hezbollah television station. I mean, they're constantly running pictures of George Bush and Hitler back-to-back and showing all the different wars that America has, you know, created, all sorts of, they count the casualties from Vietnam, from Korea, from World War II, from et cetera, Hiroshima. This is the sort of thing that you'll see on some of these other channels. So Al Jazeera, all things considered, the Arab world says, well, this is more moderate. This is more straightforward news, because they do it in the same manner that a Western news outlet would do. So I don't know how much of an effect it will have. The hope is, of course, that it will start.
I have a question, but I just want to say one thing about Al Jazeera, and that is to call attention to the possible analogy of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which we now know were largely funded, if not in total, by the CIA, and which I think people in the post-Cold War era will tell you played a major role, because people understood after a while that they were getting the truth and they could rely on it. So I don't discount the idea of a television station that is funded by the U.S. government being significant. My question is this: over the weekend, the Times reported on the resumption of the Friday services held by the Shiite, say, radicals. And they interviewed a number of people in the aftermath, and there were rallies, and the basic idea was, we need to have an Islamic State with Sharia, and we need to get rid of the U.S. as fast as possible. What can we do about this, given our military preponderance there right now, and what, in your opinion, should we do?
Well, this is something that we've, the United States government has been working with for quite some time, and actually, if you watch, what's been happening is people have been backed different horses, actually, in different parts of the government. You have different factions that are being supported by the CIA, by the State Department, by the Pentagon. Everybody has a different vision in mind. So there's a lot of discord just among the American government, which isn't helping anything right now, to be honest. I mean, it's quite difficult for us to sort of put together a good civil administration and a good interim government when there really isn't any unanimity among the American government to try to figure out what we're going to do next year. So that's been a little difficult to watch. But I think that, you know, I don't think we're going to watch a democracy sort of spring up out of nowhere. I mean, what you're watching is, I think that it would be, you would see a great deal of instability emerge in Iraq. I mean, the Shiites have basically had zero amount of, they've had zero influence on government, you know, in 30-some years. And they represent 60% of the population. To go from zero to 60, so to speak, would be extremely, extremely difficult for the rest of the population to handle. I think the United States would probably do very well to actually create sort of a combination of Kurds, Sunni, Shia, secular Shia, religious Shia, et cetera, put together a combination, some sort of a council where people can, you know, where they'll begin to vote and make decisions. But, you know, I think if you held a vote tomorrow and, you know, and 60% of the Shia wanted a more religious state, you're going to have a mess on your hands. So I think what we're going to do is the United States is going to bring this along slowly. We're going to bring in an interim government first, and then after that, you know, we'll see what happens. I think the idea is in a couple of years to have the first real election, but in the meantime, put in people that represent popular views inside Iraq. But I would even say that the radical Shia, for instance, the Iranian-backed Shia, I don't know how much they represent out of the population. They're 60% of the population. 60% of the population is Shia, but not so many are of the radical variety. There are many, many secular Shia, and in fact, most of the Iraqi opposition, the INC, etc., are secular Shia for that matter.
The program was indistinguishable from the Taliban.
And I think one of the important things will be not to give them a voice. To make sure that they're not, you know, in other words, for every, you know, radical Shia you put on television right now, especially on our new network and in other places, you put on somebody that has a secular vision, Ahmed Chalabi or some of the Kurdish voices, etc. Because, you know, there are still 4 million people in the north who don't want a radical Islamic state, who have been operating in the north, you know, a democracy for the last 10 years or so. So for every radical voice, I think, you know, there are secular voices there. I think the important thing is just to make sure that they're being heard. But, you know, just to piggyback on the Radio for Europe, we have actually a very popular program going on right now inside Iraq and inside the Arab world. It's called Radio Sawa. It's funded in part by the State Department, and it's probably our most popular initiative inside the Arab world right now. The problem is that the people actually love the music, but as soon as the news comes on, they turn it off. So the idea is that we're going to have to try to figure out how to keep the news on as well. Yeah, exactly. Subliminal messages underneath the music. Or something.
It's even done, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Did the war show definite connections to terrorism? I know there was a group of 200 terrorists in the north of Kurdistan. Then they found some training camps. They found the fuselage of an airplane, and someone said that was not the trained Air France pilots. But I wonder about that. My question is, what's the evidence that there's real connection to terrorism?
Well, we've caught a couple of terrorists. Obviously, we've heard a number of some of the big catches in the news recently. The Ansar al-Islam group, the Al-Qaeda group, operating out of northern Iraq, it appears that we're going to have more evidence on that group soon. As it stands right now, though, the larger ties are actually to Iran. And as far as the fuselage is concerned, as I understood it, that was in Salman Pak, which actually it was proven to be the plane that people had trained on for hijacking and terror techniques. This is as I understood it, this is the same exact one.
The World Trade Center terrorists?
Oh, we don't know. I mean, that's difficult to prove, but we know that there have been terrorists that have been trained on hijacking tactics and all sorts of things inside this fuselage, which is just outside of Baghdad. We know that that was. I mean, we've known about that. The intelligence had known about that for quite some time. We've yet to see, unfortunately, we've yet to see some of the things that we've been able to prove. But I can guarantee you that for the weeks leading up to the war, perhaps months, I mean, we put, unfortunately, as I said, we put Iraq on notice for quite some time. And I think that if they want to get rid of, all the damning evidence, they had ample time to do it. And I think that that's going to be one of the difficult things. We're going to have a hard time finding that. You may find that there's evidence in Syria. And I think that the more of this deck of cards that we catch, I think you have more and more people sort of spilling the beans and letting us know where this where this evidence is or what the Iraqi regime has been behind in the past. But, I mean, I don't think there's any question that there has been terrorist activity that's come out of Iraq, and I don't think there's any question that there have been chemical and biological and possibly even nuclear weapons being developed there. It's a question of how we're going to find them. Incidentally, in terms of, people have been very nervous about why haven't we found the weapons of mass destruction yet. Well, if you think about what happened last time around, it took 3 years until 1994 for us to find the basis of that nuclear weapons program. It may take just as long, if not longer, because, at this point they've really taken care to hide a lot of these things. We found a number of very interesting things so far, but, no smoking gun, so to speak, just yet. But I'm not worried. I think we'll find it.
Jonathan, you've commented on the misinformation delivered by Arab television. Have you studied the American television in the same respect?
I have. I would tune into Fox and MSNBC for a little sanity, just to make sure I still had my priorities straight. One of the things that I did find is that American television did not show casualties at all. We did not see deaths. We did not see. We didn't see any of the sort of bloody things of war. It was very, very glazed over. We focused on shock and awe. We focused on how amazingly fast this has been going. They showed a couple of fights, but I think the fights that we saw were American dominated, long distance, sort of remote control, pressing buttons. There was not really a sense of the sort of blood and guts of war, the hell of war, so to speak. And that's what you did see on Al Jazeera and Al Manar. You saw, kids that were injured. You saw people that were missing arms and legs. You saw babies crying. You saw the effect of the bombing in the neighborhoods where kids were walking around completely disoriented, and you could tell that there was some stress and fatigue going on. And that wasn't really what I think the United States media wanted to portray. I think there was, all things considered, there was a little bit more shown on CNN than there were on MSNBC and Fox. I'm not a media analyst, but what I can say is I saw a little bit more of that kind of coverage on CNN. And specifically now that the war's over, there's a real heavy focus on CNN right now, showing this one child who had lost both of his arms and things along those lines. We had the bureau chief of Al Jazeera speak at the Institute a little while ago. He said, if you're unhappy with seeing these images, then don't go to war. And he's right to a certain extent. I mean, I can say that, you know, but we just didn't get it. And I think that's probably where we were lacking the most in our coverage, was just seeing how difficult this was for the Iraqi people. I don't know what the casualty figures are right now, but we didn't see how this really affected the average people on the ground. All things considered, though, I think the Iraqi people are quite happy at having Saddam gone, and I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of residual anger over this. I think there are obviously people who are upset that they lost loved ones, but I think at the end of the day, most of the Iraqi people are pleased with the liberation.
Okay. Two quick questions. Is Al Jazeera state-owned or privately owned?
It is privately owned. It is owned by it's owned by the people of the Qatari government. So it's very funny. They say it's the freest coverage of the Arab world. It's very interesting. It's very anti-Saudi, which is very Qatari. You won't see them actually dwell on Qatari politics at all. If there's anything going on inside Qatar, for instance, the Al Udeid base that the Qataris put in about $1 billion to invite the Americans. That's where CENTCOM was based out of during this entire war. There was very, very little said about it. In fact, actually, I was on one of the shows. I had a chance to go on Al Jazeera a couple months ago, and that was the one time that they did talk about it. It was a very interesting experience. What they did is they kind of stacked the deck and had a few people sort of saying, well, you know, we have a right to do this. The Qataris should be able to do it. But by the way, we'll talk about anything we want, even if it's Qatari politics, just to let everybody know that they're trying to keep it a little bit more fair and balanced. But it very much has a Qatari slant, and if the Qatari government said, you know, we don't want this to air, I think you'd probably see a clampdown. I think a lot of the time, though, it's self-edited. I think that the people who run Al Jazeera know exactly what can and cannot be showed on air.
Second question was, what effect will the Islamic insurgency have on the Arab street, and not within Iraq, for example, I don't want to get into the Shia, Sunni, etc., but in the other countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, Libya, well, Egypt, Jordan?
You know, I can't really speak to that. It's not really my area of expertise. I have seen some effects so far. You've seen, for instance, in Hezbollah and Hamas, there was initially a sense of, we're going to stay out of this. We're not going to attack Americans unless we're attacked first. There was a sense of keeping things at bay. And then all of a sudden there was a change in tactics, and you had some of these leaders coming out and saying, Fadlallah, for instance, said it's okay for suicide bombings. Ahmed Yassin said it's okay to repel the infidel. Things along these lines have been a little dangerous, although I don't know how much of an effect they've really had, all things considered. The one area where I think we did see actually was the Mufti of Syria, a guy that we never heard of before, probably in our lives. This is a guy that never had a voice in Arab politics. All of a sudden came out one day after Syria started rattling in favor and said, okay, it's suicide tactics are okay, and it's time to go and fight the enemy on Iraqi soil and liberate, etc. And that's had some effect. You've seen thousands of people stream in from Syria, but I think that was really more of the government itself puppeteering a little bit. And this is a guy that you've never heard of, has absolutely no clout, and all of a sudden, go ahead and attack. So, I can't really say how much it's going to have an effect in the future, but I would say it's worth keeping an eye on.
Way back there. You.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you mentioned that the Arab Street really was far quieter than we expected, and to the extent that there was an outbreak, perhaps that was good.
Mm-hmm.
But you had an exception that was a Palestinian
thing.
And I'd like to, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little more about what is inciting the Palestinian Street from your perspective, and what it is, if anything, that can be done to begin to end on
the having worked with Daniel for a while, I can tell you that the answer to that is I think there needs to be a defeat on the part of the Palestinian people. There needs to be an acceptance that there is no one that's going to. If you actually look at what the Palestinians have looked for over the years, there's always been this thought that perhaps they'd be saved by Nasserism, by pan-Arabism, or by Islamic fundamentalism, or in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, by Saddam. There's always been a sense that they will be redeemed. That Palestine, from the river to the sea, as they call it, will be redeemed at some point. That there will be some sort of Arab victory that would defeat Israel. And I think that they're still holding on to that. And I think that that's the sort of thing that you saw out in the streets. anytime that there's a war, and there was you know, obviously a lot of questions about whether Israel would be attacked with Scuds, and that's why we brought in all the Patriot and other missiles to try to defend. But there was a sense that Israel could be attacked again by Saddam, and that if Saddam had chemical or biological weapons, that he would try to attack Israel and could wipe out population centers as a result. And I think that this spoke to a radical element of the Palestinian people. And what you saw is you saw Hamas, and you saw, you know, Islamic Jihad or Al-Aqsa Martyrs, et cetera, sending people out to Iraq to fight the Americans. You saw things that, you know, were very disconcerting for, you know, anyone that's been trying to follow the peace process, because incidentally, the whole time that this was happening, you had some pretty good progress happening on the ground inside the Palestinian Authority. You had Abu Mazen coming in, trying to put together a new government, trying to, bring some sort of sense of liberalization into a Palestinian society that had been so beaten over the years. What they found was, is over the years, is that the more they tried to destroy Israel, the more they ended up defeating themselves. And we saw this over almost two years now. And they clung to this again, that Saddam could defeat them, or that perhaps they would even be able to go and fight the Americans. There are people from Fatah that went and sent people to Iraq. So, you know, what I'm hoping is that this is going to be a solid defeat. This will really take the wind out of their sails. They're going to realize that they're going to have to negotiate again. But I think first they're going to have to just really, you know, renounce violence altogether. And this is something that Daniel's been saying for some time, and I completely agree with. They have to accept the state of Israel first and accept the fact that they're going to have to make state building their number. I don't think they can do both. They're going to have to either try to destroy Israel or create a state. By doing both, they destroy themselves. And until they make that choice, you're going to find themselves in that same spot. It's unfortunate for them.
Yeah,
exactly. It seems to me that the problem comes down to the might and flow of Saudi Arabia to the militant Islamist movement and the Palestinians. And A, I don't know if you agree with that, but B, I'm wondering if they, why don't we know who the people are that is doing the funding, and what are we doing about Saudi?
This is definitely not my area of expertise. I work with a guy at the Institute, his former FBI. He follows the flow of funding. And he constantly sort of beats the Saudi drum. He said, this is where it all comes from. But I think there's actually two parts to it. There's the sort of, there are the saber rattlers in the region, people like Saddam, and people like Osama bin Laden, and those people that sort of represent, they're the icons of terrorism. And they're the people who sort of facilitate it through monies, through charities, etc. As I understand it, the bulk of funding does come through the Saudis, and this is something that's going to have to be focused on. I think, you know, we have a number of challenges ahead of us right now on this, and we're going to have to come back to the war on terror. We're going to have to take out more Al-Qaeda groups. One of the things that I'm working on right now is that there are what I call Al-Qaeda affiliates, small groups that are all around the Arab world that are exploiting areas of weak central authority. They're in Lebanon, they're in Yemen, they're in Algeria, there was one in northern Iraq, they've been in Egypt. We're going to have to take care of these. We're going to have to deal with the Syrians, we're going to have to deal with Iran, and we're going to have to deal with Saudi Arabia. The hope is that we've established some sort of deterrence right now, that by going in and showing the Arab world that we're able to do this very quickly, and that we you know, this will hopefully sort of inspire the fear of God, so to speak, in these countries, that they're going to begin to look around and say, geez, you know, we better get our act together. Trying to explain this to a bunch of people who are not at all in the policy world, I said it's sort of like you have a bunch of people on the street who are stealing cable. And one person gets caught for it. The rest of the people are going to get, you know, it's done behind the scenes, but, you know, they know that, you know, there's somebody out there that's now looking for it. So that's the way I explain it with funding terrorism. Iraq was seen as a terror funder. I think you're going to see Syria, perhaps Saudi Arabia. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen right away, and I think there's going to be a lot of diplomatic pressure. Once we begin to mop up a little bit in Iraq, we'll begin to shift our focus. But I think that's going to have to be a major area of focus, and I think we're going to have to take a heavier hand. Daniel has actually written quite a bit on how we've been very weak when dealing with the Saudis. We're going to have to take a tougher stand.
Do you have a question over here?
Yes.
I have sort of a different reaction to the new inferred from the Arab news media that if I were an Arab and this is all I got to see in my language and I knew they had embedded reporters watching it in real time, I'd say, gee, there must be something even bigger than they. I wouldn't say they reported wrong, but they didn't find this out. I think the net result is that they would fear America more than just winning the war. That we have something that's serious. I think would be a terrible mistake for America to give up. And he won up to that fear. We need it. That's what we've been doing. And I think that the terrorists are the arm, are the method, a desperate method for those people who are religionists of all kinds. They're part of the democratic society. And that's really the problem. I don't know how you go about it. I'm not saying it's easy, but I think that you shouldn't give up the power that we want. And I think that we have to put all secular people in, 100%, and try to get them to a Bill Cosby or something.
Baywatch, Baywatch. That's the most popular channel in the Middle East. That's the most popular show.
Yeah. Getting back to Algeria, I've been watching a lot of CNN. My impression is that the things that you were talking about, that the bias in the report, didn't come out in CNN's reporting. So to me, that's newsworthy in itself, that they were so biased in their reporting, because a lot of Americans buy into Al Jazeera. And you can read it and you can talk to people. So my question is, is that your impression too, that the way that CNN treated Al Jazeera's reporting, and if it's true, why?
Well,
are they connected? Do they depend on Al Jazeera? Is that all tied in?
There's they buy footage from Al Jazeera. And I don't know how this works. I mean, if anybody saw the piece by Ethan Jordan last week in the New York Times. There's quite a bit that CNN hides because they, for various reasons. And I worked there some time ago, and people would say that, there are certain things about Iraq we just don't say, we just don't do. And there were certain deals that were cut to allow CNN reporters to stay. They have the best access out there. I don't know what was cut. I don't know how that works. But, it's possible that they had the same sort of deal going. But, I don't think that they made judgment calls, actually, in terms of, I don't think they passed judgment on Al Jazeera reporting. I think at least from what I saw from CNN, is they just said, Al Jazeera reports this, and then went on to show the footage, etc. Whether it was accurate or not was, they're just saying this is who reported it, which is, and then went on to show the footage, etc. Whether it was accurate or not was, they're just saying this is who reported it, which is, I guess, there's, you can ask John, he's the resident journalist here, but that is journalistic integrity to be able to say, so-and-so else, these people reported it, we can't confirm or deny whether this is the case or not. And I think that's really what you saw on CNN. But it did give Jazeera a certain amount of credibility. I did see CNN doing that. But in fact, actually, other channels, C-SPAN actually ran Al-Manar for a little while. C-SPAN ran Hezbollah television. For an hour or two, which was unbelievable to me. I couldn't believe that, that this was something that they wanted to show the American public. They had an American translator explaining what was being said the whole time. That, to me, is unbelievable. Showing, Jazeera, if they have new footage that we haven't seen, whether it be favorable to the American effort or not, I can sort of understand it, but, airing a terrorist television station is something very different. Yeah.
I guess NASDAQ dumped Al Jazeera. Is this what? It was interesting. Not my question. My question is about, I don't even have much time, Turkey. Can we count on Turkey as an anchor after what happened? What's going on?
I've been working with a colleague of mine, and he does Turkey nonstop. That's his thing. He's from Istanbul. I have to tell you, I was very disappointed in Turkey in the sense that he didn't allow us on board. But I think at the end of the day, it was a good thing to put a positive spin on sort of a negative, something that received a lot of negative publicity. One, in the Middle East world, we've always talked about propping up Turkey as the one Islamic democracy that the rest of the Arab world can sort of look to as a poster child, if you will. Turkey voted in a democratic way to not allow the United States onto its soil. I can tell you that's a much better way than attacking the United States or there was a lot of other diplomatic rows that went on between the United States and the Arab world during this time, a lot of them behind the scenes, but this was something that was done in a very legitimate way, and I have to say that it probably showed how legitimate the Turkish democracy is. It's a little disappointing given the millions of dollars we put in for our air bases. It would have been nice to be able to use them, but on top of that though, I think it also helped us make good on ensuring that the Kurds didn't get a bum deal. The Kurds have been, you know, we've really not given the Kurds a fair shake over the years. Over a couple of times, the Kurds have sort of been shafted by United States policy decisions. And in this way, we kept the Kurds and the Turks away from each other, prevented, I think, what could have been a very messy situation. And in essence, I think everything worked out in the end. We ended up not spending $30 million to keep them in the coalition. We ended up being able to handle this quite well on our own without that Northern Front. Maybe we would have been able to shave 4 or 5 days off of the campaign. But in the end...
Billions.
Didn't mean to say money. There's a big difference. But yeah, so we saved a great deal of money, and it didn't really affect our campaign. All things considered, we still did exceptionally well. It was a lightning fast campaign, and we didn't have to let we didn't allow the Kurds and the Turks to mix it up. So I think that might have been a positive outcome here.
It also reflects well on the U.S. Respecting the sovereignty of Turkey and not just bulldozing. Was the air temporarily? Was that war damage?
Yeah. What happened? Well, their websites were attacked, number one. There was a big American flag strewn across it for I think about a half day. But then also on top of that, they cut off one of their correspondents was killed in an American bombing raid. And so they were showing a good bit of that, and then I think they pulled coverage for a little while, and then they put it back on the air. But there was a big diplomatic row over the killing of that one correspondent. Yeah.
Do you think there's any possibility at all of a population shift of Kurds from Turkey to Turkmenistan in northern Iraq?
No way. One of the things, you know, I've often get into conversations with our Turkish expert, and I say, well, what's wrong with creating a Kurdish state? Why not, bring people into northern Iraq, let them leave Turkey, let them leave wherever, and if you make it a Kurdish state. And that's just such a no-no with the Turks.
I'm not saying a Kurdish state. I'm saying a population
transfer. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if the Turkmen would want to leave. I don't know if the Kurds would like that kind of population shift in among their own. As I understand it, Turkmen are seen as minorities even among the Kurds. So I don't know if that would be seen as a very popular move. Yeah.
I have a question for the future.
Uh-oh.
You know, there are roughly, let's say, 300,000 Arabs
mm-hmm.
in the world, okay? There's roughly... 300 million. There's roughly... 1.2 billion Muslims in the world today, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Roughly 15% of the Muslims are anti-American, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what percentage of the Arabs are anti-American, or all of them, but what I'm really asking is this. Are these two going to combine to try to defeat America? Are they going to try to do it separately? Now, I know in the end, they're going to be defeated. There's no question in my mind that the fundamentalists are going to be defeated, those who are trying to destroy the world. So what I would like you to answer, if at all possible, in terms of the future of what's going to end up in.
If I knew that, I'd be in the White House. but, and this is something that Daniel talks about all the time. You know, you have 15, 20% of the Muslim world. that is seen as fundamentalist. The good news is that there's 80 or 85% that are more moderate to varying degrees. The problem is that you still have about 260, maybe 280 million people out there that have a very fundamentalist outlook on the world. A battle between Islam and the West that's sort of ordained in the stars and things along those lines. We have our work cut out for us. They continue to grow very, very quickly. And we have our work cut out for us in terms of trying to find ways of mitigating that. We're going to have to start, propping up moderates, just the way we're doing in Iraq right now, finding secular people who we can count on. We're going to have to find those same moderate voices, whether they be in Turkey, whether they be in Iraq, doesn't matter where. And this is the beginning of it, as I see it. This war in Iraq is probably a very good first step if we're trying to find those moderates, perhaps, giving them a platform, giving them a place to speak. Hopefully Iraq will be one of them, and we'll hopefully begin to see more and more of this, but it's going to be tough to tell.
Last question?
First thing, you mentioned about the media not showing the dead bodies in Iraq. Remember, the World Trade Center, dead bodies in the World Trade Center here.
Right. Right. No, but there have been times where, for instance, in 1993, after the attacks in Mogadishu, we did see some of that on television. There have been, there are different times where I guess, the media makes judgment calls, or they're perhaps, I don't know if they're told by the government to not to, or, a lot of the time it's generally, at least with American casualties, it's been about waiting to identify people, letting the families know before, that sort of thing. But there was a sense, at least on Al Jazeera, that there was a sense of showing American bodies or showing American POWs was giving the Arab world a sense that they were winning. Even if we had captured 200 or killed 1,000 or whatever, to show 5 people on television who were captured by the Iraqis was to show that the Americans were not invincible, and that was the sort of disconnect there.
You also mentioned, it seems to me, it sounds like you think Abu Mazen is someone.
Oh, he does.
Oh,
I'm not putting any weight behind him. I think it's been positive that he's been one of the few outspoken people for a ceasefire. And he's, for the last year plus, he's been one of the people who's seen the futility of the ongoing intifada. So I think that's a good first step. But right, looking in the territory. So he's got, he's a very questionable background. I mean, here's a lifelong Fatah member, a lifelong terrorist, essentially. What I am happy about, though, is you're beginning to see at least a process of liberalization that they're going to try to sort of infuse into the Palestinian territories. Whether this takes root or not, I can't tell you, but what I can say is that I think it's at least a positive first step anyway, if you're trying to sort of reverse some of the damage that's happened over the last couple of years. I'm not going to say that we're going to see a turnaround. And like I said, I don't think that we'll even have an opening for an adversarial peace negotiation until there's an out-and-out rejection of violence. So while Hamas is still involved, we're going nowhere fast.
Turkey had cooperated. The 4th Infantry Division had gotten into the north. There have been a lot of lives saved because the Kurds came in and took out revenge. Right? I understand why.
Yeah.
But if we had another division up north,
I think
we'd have gotten water up sooner than the Syrians. It would have been a lot better.
Yeah, you're right.
I think you're right. The 4th Infantry was able to get in. They had the high-tech communications. They've already linked them. So you fired them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.